just like to listen to it for a minute before we go.
We think it sounds very dramatic.
Very Seattle, kind of, except for it's Seattle summertime.
So. You want me to talk over this shit?
We can.
Yeah. Or how do you do that? I'm new at this.
I can bring it down.
You can start. Poor her. Look at it. He's going, what the fuck did I get into? These guys have no idea. They're set up in the service station. Fucking everybody's got a goddamn podcast, for fuck's sake. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, ships at sea, we have Hurry, Kara, Honda. Fuck this guy. This guy. I told you.
That was your chance.
I told you.
Yeah, you got nervous. Everyone's watching it.
Oh, man.
I get to try. Right. Hurry, Kondabalu.
Hari Kondabolu.
Kondabolu.
Hari Kondabolu.
Kondabolu. I mean, you know, it's a very. To be honest, it took me like years.
It took me years to master it as well.
It didn't take you years to master your name.
Well, yeah, he was probably two before he said it. Fucking three, maybe. It's a long fucking name.
Long name. My middle name is Karthikeya. Hari Karthikeya Kondabolu.
How do you spell that middle name?
K A R T H I K E Y A, which actually I did not know how to spell until I was about 12.
12.
I was misspelling it for years. I had no idea. No.
Wow. I know what you mean, though.
My mom used to, she still does, she tells me to keep my middle initial in my name, so if there's ever another Hari Kondabolu, there's no confusion.
That's going to fucking take away. Like, your middle name is X, perhaps, right. My fucking Q, I like to.
I still sign my name with a K in the middle.
That's like what Hennigan said. That's why you're getting famous, or you got to get famous, so your
so
name.
So people say my name,
so they
right.
say your name.
Well,
right.
You're yeah. just kicking ass, dude. Everywhere I turn, I hear
okay.
you're doing.
We read your
else.
Wiki, and it was like, usually you have two things to talk about, and you can remember them. And, dude,
I don't know how this is happening, but it's happening. Well, it's funny because whenever
it's
I come back,
because you're funny, that's why it's happening.
Yeah, but you mean funny people? Like Anakin's funny.
Yeah,
you know,
a lot of people are funny.
A lot of people are funny, but
it's your path.
But
though,
you're like a triple threat. It's like, do you dance too? By the way,
no. I feel like
you have a master's degree from.
Yeah, but that doesn't help in comedy.
Oh, I know, but it's accomplishments, and then now
sure.
you're here.
Well, yeah. So are you saying it also takes luck then?
Or? Oh, it's obviously. It's so much luck, and I mean, I still, like, I moved to Seattle. Do you remember this? I moved to Seattle to be an immigrant rights organizer. That's what I was doing when I moved here. I had an AmeriCorps position. I was working in an immigrant rights nonprofit, and I became a full-time organizer. Comedy was something I loved to do, and the underground, like Carl and Ron, were amazing to me. They always gave me all the stage time. I remember after the first or second time I did a open mic, Carl said, "Why don't you come down on the weekend? I'll give you a set." I didn't know that was a big deal. I'd never.
Yeah, really? Your second open mic, he offered you weekend time?
He's like, why don't you do this on a weekend? And I'm like, I didn't know. Because in New York, I couldn't get time anywhere, you know? Because as a kid, like, you had to pay for stage time, or you had to bring 30 of your friends, and then you lose those friends, and you have to make new friends and bring that. You know, it's stupid. It's a scam, right? It's a pyramid scheme. And, you know, I lived in Queens with my parents, and to head into the city is like, you know, like an hour. It's like basically going to Bellingham for an open mic, right? It didn't make any sense.
Yeah.
And so. To come here and get stage time, I didn't know it was a big deal, and I thought it was amazing. Like I could go up. I knew that like it was so much easier than New York. But so then I'd come up on weekends and I'd do these guest sets, and then within a year I was featuring. My goal for the whole time in sales, I'd like to feature one day at the Underground, and if I could ever perform at Bumbershoot one day, and that was my long term goal, and that's all. Peter put me on the Bumbershoot lineup. Because Fahim Anwar had moved to Los Angeles. He had moved to L.A. This is the luck part. And so he put me on the bill because they were one short, and like he liked me, and so he put me on. And J.P. Buck, who was then working for the HBO Comedy Festival, he was going through the Bumbershoot lineups. He'd never seen my name before. So we Googled it and went to my website. I had a couple of old clips from a show I'd done in New York. It was the only show I'd done in New York in like 2 years. It was a good show. I had clips, saw the clips, wanted more stuff. I started like recording my sets. D'Artagnan London happened to record a set once that I had done. I sent him that. He liked that. The next thing you know, he's like, why don't you come down to San Francisco for an audition?
Wow.
I'd never been to San Francisco before, never auditioned for anything, didn't know how any of that worked, how you develop a little set to do in front of, like, never done any of that. Did it. It was okay. He said, why don't you come down to LA for the callback? I knew that was a big deal. I'd never been to Los Angeles before, so go to Los Angeles, nervous as shit. I'm like, this counts as a thing, and I didn't even know this was possible, and it's here. And I get there, and I'm like, I'm freaking out. And then all of a sudden, Ty Barnett shows up, and Ty was hosting the audition, the callback.
Oh, awesome.
And it was like, of all the people I'd want to see, he's exactly who I wanted to see. Like, it's somebody who was, like, from Seattle, who, like, was always really supportive, always told me, you'll be fine. You'll find your way. You'll be fine. And he saw me. He was happy to see me. He's like, you'll be fine. Just calm down. I got 3 applause breaks in 7 minutes. I've never had a nice. 7-minute set that was that good. And I remember when I got on stage, like the mic had come out of the cord. And I'm like, I'm fucked. It's over. I'm fucked. I plugged it back and did the set. And I remember just Ty, like, just gave me a hug. And he said, like, you got it. You probably got it. I think you got it. It was just really, like, it was good. So I don't know, man. It's just random shit.
And you were lucky. So it's just blind luck.
It's blind luck. You work hard. You have to come up with jokes in a set. But, like, you know, so much of this is, like.
But you were featuring, you know, a year in?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, but dude, that's where I think that your background kind of comes into play. I mean, there's a certain amount of life that you lived and right. things that you've done, so now you have stuff to talk about.
Well, I mean, I came in a funny kind of way because, like, I'd done stand-up through college and I'd done it in, like, you know, in high school, but it was like, you know, you don't think it's real.
What kind of fucking places did you play in high school?
The auditorium.
The high school auditorium.
I started a comedy night called Comedy Night. That's what I called it.
In high school, you started a comedy night.
I ran for the vice president of my student union because they wouldn't give me a comedy night. So then I won it so I could get it. So that's exactly what I did.
All right. Well, so earlier we were talking about how much luck is involved.
Yeah, and
but
you're
listen,
working.
Listen to this determination. You're in high school. Yeah. They won't give you a comedy night.
That's not what I want.
So you run for office so you can institute your own
comedy night.
And
right.
then you go up and host and star in that
that's
comedy
correct.
Night.
I did.
So
that's
you use
not luck. That's aspiration.
That's beautiful. Great.
Were there other kids that showed
there
up
was,
and they wanted to perform too?
So you crushed other kids' dreams and had wanted to be the
well, there were a bunch of kids who, like, we didn't do any. We went to, like, a nerd school in Queens. It was, like, one of those magnet type schools, and so nobody really did anything other than study and do what they had to do, and it wasn't a big sports school or anything. So the fact that somebody actually wanted to do anything, people were excited about. So I had all these kids sign up to, like, do stand up or do sketches or write or even just to be there and help with the crew and stuff.
Were any of them good?
Well, don't you think
high school good? Not like real. You know what I mean? Yeah. Just like if you do anything, there was this one kid that was. He was great. He could do impressions of almost every teacher in school. He crushed. It was about him. At the end of it, it wasn't about me anymore. It was his comedy. He was incredible.
How
man.
Long were the sets?
Everybody, he did about 15, and then he got an encore, and he had to come back out.
You guys are doing 15 minutes.
How much time did you do?
45.
45?
Garbage.
You did 45
45
minutes?
Of, like, mostly other people's material and, like, some of my Jeez. Stuff. Like, that was in high school. So I had
high
like,
school. He's doing 45
I had some
minutes.
Of Jeff Ross's poetry tour stuff that he did in Comedy Central. I probably did some of Chris Rock's bits, like... I was like, this is Jeff Ross's. I didn't understand that you couldn't just. I thought it was like school. If I say who it's from, I can do it. Like, I did that.
How long
so
that
you were
happened.
Citing your sources?
I was like, yeah, I'm citing my sources. I'm like, oh, that's cool. Like, I told Jeff Ross that once actually when I was probably like 19. I went to the Comedy Cellar and I met him. I'm like, I did your thing in my high school, and I did. And he was so pissed. He was. I'm like, I was 17. don't do my joke. I'm like, I was 17. 17. The 17.
Did you tell him you were citing your sources? The whole
I said it was him. I said it was you. And he's like,
how long did it take you to figure out that wasn't the way it was supposed to be done?
I mean, I kind of knew, but it was also like I'm in a high school. It's like closed circuit television, right? Like no one's really seeing this, and so right. it was kind of like.
Was it taped at all?
It was recorded, but it got cut off at intermission, so my set never got recorded. It broke my heart when I realized that they ran out of batteries midway through. But yeah, I mean that was big. It was like I thought I would just do it once in high school and I'd be done with it. And I went to college and I'm like, I went to college in Maine. I grew up in Queens and I'm like, I got to do something here, right? So then started writing and I was the only one doing stand up. So like by my senior year, I was getting like a couple of hundred kids coming to open mics to watch me do like sets. And I was getting better, but I wasn't like good.
They were coming to watch you. You had a crowd for open mics?
Yeah.
Wow.
It was like, so, you know, I did like an hour the last show I did and I'd filled up an auditorium. So when I got to Seattle, like I had stage experience. I knew how to do an hour, but none of it was really that great. I had a few good bits. But mostly it was just I knew how to handle myself on stage. So, like, coming to Seattle, it was great because, like, I actually got stage time in front of a real audience with adults and, like, a really like an incredible city that's engaging, where I would get into incredible conversations and write things down and think about a lot of stuff. So, and an audience that would actually pay attention to me. And even the open mics, like the comics were so supportive. As soon as I got here, they were supportive. So, you know, and that was that 05 to 07 period when the People's Republic of Comedy, and there was that little two-year gap when that started with Emmett and Dan Carroll and Scott Moran, Kevin Hyder, and they were doing all these shows, and they wanted to be a part of it, and The Stranger wrote about comedy, so I was getting all these, like, young audiences and hip audiences, and all these things. How old am I? At all these different venues. So it was like I came at the right... That was the luck part. I just happened to show up when there was a little boom in comedy in Seattle, and
well,
the paper
plus,
was writing.
Well, plus, you came
that.
With a lot of skills. It's like, I don't ever remember you being the guy starting out.
Right.
You know, it's just like, he just got here, and it's like, I don't know where he came from. You know, I really didn't know your history.
I remember Dan Carroll said that, like, he was so angry when I showed up. Like,
he just showed up, yeah. Just fully formed, yeah. And doing comedy. Yeah. It's just like, well, obviously, this guy's been on stage before. This is not...
I knew that, but the actual writing part, like, you know, just like everybody, just that took a while. I needed a club, and I needed a regular stage to do it. I mean, I remember the first open mic that you were hosting.
Of course. That's what I do. I host.
It's true. The first open mic I did, I'm pretty sure you were hosting also.
God, I used to host a lot. You
did
know?
You host only open mics? Did you host like any other thing?
No, sometimes I'd host, but usually if it was a weekend, I would at least feature.
Right, right.
I got to work with a bunch of people that, you know, come through town. So.
Well, how long did it take for you to feature?
A lot longer than it did you, young guy.
But I came with, you know, some skill.
Well, technically, within the first... 6 or 8 months I was on the road,
right.
As a feature,
right.
But I had maybe 15
what years
minutes.
Were those though? What years was that? Like what time? What like
1995, 1996.
So there was a lot of there was a lot of shows to go do. So a lot of people could.
There was
get
a
on
lot that. Of road work, and you know, I mean, I could talk to an audience. I just hadn't really written enough jokes to fill up any time, you know, but.
I mean, were you? I mean, when you started, did you write jokes, or were you kind of just going on stage and like, we'll see what happens, and I'll take notes?
No, I didn't know anything about doing this. When I started in '93, you really couldn't pick up a book about comedy. There was no fucking internet or anything.
Right.
And so I thought what you did was you wrote 5 minutes of jokes, you did your open mic, and then you went back the next time and you had a different 5 minutes.
That's good.
Of jokes. So. I would get the newspaper that day and sit down and get my 5 minutes. I'd go to open mic and do that 5 minutes. And then the next night, I would have a different 5 minutes. And I did that for a year, and I didn't know any better. I thought that's the way you did it. And I didn't know that you could go to the shows at the Comedy Underground. If you were a comic, you could get in free. So I never saw any of the headliners. That whole year, all I'd ever done was open mic. I'd never seen a professional comedy show. For the most part.
But you were doing stuff that, like, only once ever, and then you would start over.
Yeah, it's just, you know, I mean, I was trying, but I don't have a linear type of mind, I guess. And I thought, well, if you just write a whole bunch of stuff, something will always pop in. So that works better for me than to try to remember, because I get stressed if it's like, okay, now I do this joke, and then I go into this joke.
Right.
But I think it probably is an impediment to, you know, because you never know what the fuck is going to happen. And people like to know what you're going to say.
But you like that, though. You like the idea that there might be an improvisational moment if I'm just...
I like it very much because every night is a different night. Every fucking show is a different show. That group will never be together again. So you got to have a little bit of room to glide around. You know, you don't want to just go up there and
I think I think that makes you immediately likable, and so they're just right with you.
Yes, that's right.
And so whatever you do, they're going to go with, because it's real.
Yeah.
Do you write much on stage,
Aaron? Yeah, you know, I started to. Initially, but like when I moved here, I'd write every single word out, and I would try to say it exactly the way I wrote it. And, you know, there's adjustments after that, but like the first time, like, I would try to do that. And then after a while, I realized, like, it was restricting my ability to actually, like, create on stage. Because, like, I'm thinking about, well, I wrote it this way. But, like, that's, like, denying the fact that I'm funny when I'm not writing. Like, when you're hanging out with your friends, you're not writing every single word out. Like, you're riffing and you're kind of going back and forth. And I'd realize, like, I'm, like, taking away a part of my personality because I'm trying to be the writer that I, that you know, the person who wrote the thing. So then I started to, I remember initially at open mics, I would have a couple of bullet points of ideas, maybe a punchline after a couple of things, but then I would just go. I'd like, create the setup, I'd create the middle, and then try to get to the joke, but I would have to find my path there. And that helped me with writing, just because I'd had the basic structure of the thing, but like I would speak more naturally.
Yeah, it was
so
very,
you'd just go on stage and do it on stage, but you'd know
where
you'd have
points,
a net.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. I'd have some
so
structure.
So basically, so every night when you're going up there, because this is how I do it. I can't sit and write.
Yeah.
I have a thought that if I'm listening to the radio, something hits me and I have an immediate thought, then I'll talk about that. Then I'll go on and I'll mess with it until it finally gets to where I want it to be.
Right,
but
right,
coming
right.
from natural conversation, because then it seems more real. Like that's how I would talk to you.
Which is what you want to convey to an audience anyway.
Right.
Like something that's
so that
natural,
once you have that set, you know a certain inflection makes it do one
thing or whatever.
How much do you play with it in the middle? It's like jazz, right? Are you messing with it?
Yes.
And going down different roads each night?
I mean, I feel like at this point, the set I'm doing right now is what I'm putting on the album, and it basically, no. A few things, because I've tweaked a couple of things, and so I've kept it a bit open, but mostly it's pretty tight. Like, this is kind of the way I want to do it. But, like, I really like when I'm doing a set and I put a few new jokes in the middle just because that those new jokes are going to make the old jokes sound new, and I'm going to be excited about it because I'm sick of telling those jokes, but I don't know how to get to those jokes from the new ones. So the segues are new, and I got to figure out a bridge, right? And that's exciting. There's a comic. My favorite comic is a British comic named Stuart Lee. Stuart Lee's a very tight writer. He writes like everything is supposed to be there, but what he does is sometimes he'll like give an example, or he'll leave room intentionally for improvisation, always. Like, whether it's a joke example or whether it's, like, a punchline that could go a number of different ways. Like, he leaves that intentionally in the set just so he has those moments where the audience doesn't get, like, oh, he's reading off a script. And that reminds them, no, I'm still engaged. And he feels excited. So I love that. I love the idea of someone who can write clearly and has these incredible way with words and at the same time, like, is a real comic. And a real comic actually uses what's in the room, right?
So are you doing an hour now?
Yeah, I'm recording an album Tuesday. It's going to be... I'm going to record now. We'll see what the edit is. But, it comes out next year on Kill Rock Stars.
And then are you one of those guys that just drops the material afterwards?
I want to try, man. I mean, like, my goal... A lot of this stuff is, like, stuff I started in, like... Some of it in 05. Some of it even, like... A couple of pieces, actually, I started, like, in college, probably, in, like, 02 or 03.
And just went and kept moving on them until they finally were the
one
you wanted them?
Because all of these jokes are kind of works in progress,
right?
Like, you find new tags or something happens in the news, and all of a sudden it just takes a new angle and stuff. So, you know, I want to retire, like, the vast majority of it. There's a few things where I'm kind of like, this is actually more of a premise that can build into a bigger thing, but I'll use it as a little joke right now. But yeah, I want to stop doing most of it. I mean, you know, it's one of those things too. Like sometimes you're in a room that is rough, and then you're not thinking about new stuff. You're like, let me get through the set. You know, I they paid me to do this. Oh my God, I did a gig. It was at a Salus University. It's like an optometry school. I don't know why they booked me for it. And I'm like, I don't got any jokes.
Oh, you
about
got glasses.
I got glasses. I'm like, is that the requirement? So I'm like, I get there. They don't tell me until I get there that it's a reunion. It's a reunion.
Oh,
it's not
older
for the
people?
Yeah, they were all in their 70s.
Nice.
I was in a gym. There was one of those tracks that was above me, you know, like
but there weren't people running.
No, but that would have made it even better at that point. But there wasn't a chance in hell for me to do anything. Like I'm performing for the 7 years.
Now, how did you get booked at this? Did they just
some college booker was like, "Do you want to do this?" And I'm like, "Yeah."
And you're like, "Hey, college gig,
yeah,
good
it's
money."
It's Philadelphia. I'll take
dude, some
bus
of those
down.
College gigs are the worst gigs ever. I did NACA, a showcase at a NACA, and got a lot of good gigs. But then you do these ones where you're in the cafeteria at noon.
Yeah.
Standing like in front of like two dudes eating sandwiches.
It's humiliating.
But you're getting paid $2,500.
So how many 70-year-olds were in this gymnasium?
It was like not even that many either. It was probably like 30 or 40 people in tables. Tables kind of scattered about. There's no stage. So I'm standing on a
dance
floor.
Did you have a sound system?
There was a sound. There was a mic. There was no stand.
Were they eating at the time?
Mic, no stand, a chair, not a stool. They were eating.
And they weren't going to wait till after they were eating for the show.
Oh, no.
No.
They wanted me to suffer. Like, it was Robert. Somebody told me Robert Hawkins once said a thing. Sometimes when you think about shows, it's like, if there's a bag of money, let's say there's a bag of money in a city, right? And someone is paying for your plane ticket to pick up that bag of money. How much money has to be in that bag for you to pick it up? And everybody has a different number. And he's like, okay, you picked up the bag of money. Oh, there's a comedy show for me to do too? Great. And it's like, and sometimes it's like you got to think about it. It's like, all right, I guess that's enough of a bag of money. And, you know, I mean, I don't do that often. I really didn't know what this was going to be. I mainly did this because it was Philadelphia and I'm in New York.
Did they just stare at you the whole time?
A lot of it. And then afterwards, there was a lot of, my grandkids would have loved you. Oh, and it's like,
how much time did you do?
An hour.
No opener. Did you get any laughs?
Yeah, I got a few when I made fun of myself, just about I was doing my impressions of what they were seeing when they were watching the show.
Did they just talk through it, or did they just ignore you? No, they stared. Oh, so they sat and watched the whole hour.
Uh-huh.
Wow.
They just stared, and it was so...
Sometimes it's actually better if they just start talking, because then you can just kind of just drone on, and everybody just ignores each other.
Or you can break into a conversation or something.
Well, dude, right. Sometimes you don't care if it's noise in the room. You'd rather have that. That silence is horrible.
Oh, the silence is... I mean, there were moments where there was... At a certain point, like we were about 50 minutes in, I'm like, these last 10 minutes seem like they're forever. So I started asking people, like, what comics do you like? And they just yelled out comics they liked. I'm like, I like that one. I don't like that one as much, but I like that one. And then...
What were they yelling?
There was Jackie Mason.
Jackie Mason. Oh, wow.
John Stewart. Robert Klein.
Henny Youngman.
What's the name of the... I forget the name of the... He's Bobby... Sturdy. He's Sturdy. What's his name?
Bobby Slayton.
There was a lot. It was like a wide range of, stuff, and it was also like, I don't think I quite make sense here. You know, it was just a different. But then there was like.
And when were you doing those gigs? Like you were in New York?
Yeah. This was last year.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, or earlier this year. Oh God, no. This is.
So what is it? Was it 2007 that you were in that Aspen Comedy Festival?
2007. Yeah.
Is that the one that Kirk Fox was at?
Yeah.
What did he get?
He won. He with Shane Moss. He won like the best comic thing.
Yeah. He's a good friend of mine. How did it go for you?
It went all right, man. Like it wasn't incredible. Like it was funny actually. My agent my manager at Avalon contacted me before the festival, and he said like I'd like to work with you. And I said, well, I'd like to see what happens at the festival. And afterwards, they were still the only ones that were interested. So it was like, okay, let's do this. And they've been wonderful. But it was fine, man. It was fine. But it didn't like change my life or anything. And I ended up going to the London School of Economics after that to get a master's degree. And I wasn't really sold on comedy yet. Like I had a TV appearance and a manager and this credit, but I was kind of like, I don't even know if I want to do this. Like it's great and I love it, but I don't know if I can do this.
What was the problem?
I mean, it was kind of like it wasn't my plan.
Well, yeah, but most people dream. Like most people would say, I have a manager, a TV credit.
Yeah,
I've made it. I'm there.
And wait a sec, we just glossed over the master's in what? What do you have a master's in?
In human rights. I was going to get a human rights framework to do the immigrant rights organizing. I figured that would just make me a stronger organizer and stuff. And maybe I'd move back here and move to New York and. But so I didn't really do comedy for a year when I was in London, you know. I thought I would, but, like, it was just hard to, like, I hadn't been in school in a few years, and I was trying to get this degree, and I didn't do it. And it was weird. I missed it so much that year. And I was writing all the time, just like I always wrote. But
London? Is it like Seattle?
I mean, it was more expensive. That was, like, the dollar was really weak then. It was, like, a little bit more than $2 per pound, I think. So I was only eating, like, sandwiches every day and shit, making pasta. Like, I couldn't afford anything, and, like, it's a bigger city. It's more like New York. It's much more cosmopolitan. It's an international city, and it was great. And I learned a ton. I loved it, but like I missed performing. It was killing me not to perform.
Do you feel like you're compelled to do comedy? Because a lot of the comics we've talked to, a lot of times it comes up like, why do you do it? Especially in light of all the crazy, terrible stories, like the optometry. Where you're like, why do people keep doing that? And it seems like almost universally everyone says they just can't stop.
And I think that's when I realized, because that year I stopped. And all of a sudden, like, so Comedy Central wanted me to do Live at Gotham, right? I hadn't done stand-up basically in 6 months. This was 2008. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, well, they're interested, which is cool. But it's weird, but I'm not even... I go back to
New
York.
This is a guy trying to figure out what he's doing while Comedy Central's calling and all these people.
Yeah. Yeah. Most people don't have that luxury. I think I'm going to quit.
Yeah, I don't know.
I got this Gotham people calling.
It was weird. The whole thing was weird. Like, I mean, I ended up taking a week off from class. I tried to remember my jokes. I did Gotham. It went well. My brother was in the front row. It was funny. I talked to him on TV. They cut it out, but I ended up talking to him during the set. I went back, and then it was kind of like, I have to do comedy. I have to. And the reason I had it was like, one, like, I love it. I was deeply down. I was like down about not doing it. It felt weird to not. I knew that like that's what withdrawal is, right? Like I physically had to do it, and I wasn't. And I was obsessed with thinking about it, so it was clear. And also, it was that idea, like, I got a TV credit and a manager, and I got two TV credits at this point, a manager and this festival credit, and I got a master's degree behind me, which is good. And I kept thinking about, like, all the comics I'd met, like, throughout my time in Seattle, who were fucking good comics. And I got all these opportunities. I didn't ask for these opportunities, and I got them somehow, and it seemed disrespectful to not push further.
Like, yeah, a lot of guys like live out of their car for 10 years, driving around the
country
for
anything to get just something, some kind of shot. And like, I was given a shot. I'm not supposed to do anything with it. And it felt wrong not to try. And it's not like I didn't love it. Like, I obviously love it.
Did you still love comedy the moment you stepped out of that optometry building?
I didn't love comedy 20 minutes into the set, man.
How do you recover from those?
Yeah, I mean. You remember the good ones.
You just go back and look at the old footage.
You count the money in your head. Yeah. You spend the money in your head.
I mean, it fades. It fades, because you have a show like tonight.
What fades faster, the bad sets or the good sets?
What? That's hard.
What fades faster, the bad sets or the good sets?
The good sets fade faster, obviously. The bad ones stay there forever.
The bad ones hurt.
They bother you for a long time.
The good ones mostly kind of blend together, right? They're like people laughing, you had a good time. The bad ones, you remember like a heckler said this and then... The funny thing
is, though, it seems like sometimes when you have a great set, you almost go to this place where you're just kind of on autopilot and you kind of sail through it because the audience allows you to because they just love everything.
Yeah, it's easy.
And then when you have a bad set, though, you really work and flex muscles.
That's where you learn the shit.
And at some point you get to where you don't... At some point you get to where you don't even care anymore, though, where that... You use it to grow quickly. Like, you don't, like, care.
Well, I mean, I think I like learning how to recover from bombing is huge, right? Like, to actually go on stage and just, like, dying. And you're like, all right, how do I get through this set? If I get anything out of them, it's a major accomplishment.
Do you ever, like, address the fact that you're bombing or that a joke didn't work?
Sometimes I'm like, well, sometimes it's so obvious. It's like, it's been 10 minutes. We know what's going on here. This isn't great, Like, this is, I mean, so sometimes.
Sometimes it just seems like you can dig a deeper hole.
But you can pull the nose up. I watched you 3 times, like, throw them off and then bring them back.
Well, I like the idea of, like, being in control of a joke failing. Like, I like that whole, like, that Genghis Khan joke. It 90% of the time doesn't hit. And at this point, like, I need it to fail. If it hits, it'll fuck up the whole set.
Well, right. Yeah, I saw
it needs to bomb, and if it works, I need to find a way to cut off the laughs by talking quick, so it looks like they let me down. Because I need the audience to let me down, so in like 40 minutes, I can call it back with that other joke. The fact that it let me down again.
So once you know how to basically manipulate them, you're making them follow you down these roads.
Right.
There's nothing to be afraid of.
That's
our job.
You know.
How much of it is crowd manipulation? Do you think
all of it?
I don't think it's all of it. I mean, because...
Some of it's just being funny.
Right.
But
if you don't have the goods...
But you're always leading them somewhere.
You're always leading them somewhere,
and then sometimes you might want to throw them off and bring them back. I mean, always.
I mean, Kamau, my friend Kamau, who I write for, like, he says, like, a good comedy show feels like a magic trick. Like, they have no idea how they got there. They have no idea how you did it, but they're mesmerized and they're enjoying every minute of it, right? That's what it's supposed to be, a magic trick. They're not supposed to see the strings, but you're pulling strings.
Right.
You're definitely pulling strings. You know what you're doing. And even if you don't have, like, I usually come in with a somewhat tight set, and you kind of glide through it, but you still know what you're doing. You know where it has to go. You know how much time you still have to deal with. You see the different places and, like, pieces in the room, like, right, the table's chatty. This guy keeps getting up to go to the bathroom. These folks are completely focused.
You actually notice things that are... Most comics won't even... don't notice that. I think a lot of them, not most, but a lot of people go on autopilot and
just look at the wall.
Yeah, and don't know what's going on in the room.
I do that, but it also kind of depends. If the set is... If it's one of those sets like you talked about, like that's just like boom, 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 everyone's laughing all the time, yeah, then I think autopilot becomes easier. But like when you're not killing... You notice every little thing that's happening.
Right, right. Yeah, that's true.
Like, I know, he needs another drink. Does he really need another drink right now? Like, come on. Like,
do you go up there with a joke right away, or do you try to, like you do the little magic trick where you're just talking, and then before they even know it, you're actually doing material?
No, I mean, I usually go with a joke, but it depends. You know, the best sets for me are when you go up there and you improvise something. Because then the audience right off the bat is like...
It just seems like I've seen a lot of people kind of improv like at first for like just at least a couple minutes before they even tell a joke. And it's almost like...
Except he's in a different boat because he's at the point where a lot of the people that are coming to his show know who he is and know what he's about. I mean, he's been on tons of things. How many Twitter followers do you have?
That's somewhere between 18,000, 19,000.
Yeah, and I heard somebody say... congratulations on your certification or whatever.
They gave you a blue check, yeah.
So that means, you know, that's a pretty solid... I mean, so they know what they're in for.
Oh, you're a verified Twitter account now.
I think... because me and my brother did a piece about it. We have a show that we do in New York and about, like, my brother has a check because he was in a hip-hop group and he had gotten a check.
Yeah, what hip-hop group was that?
Das Racist.
Okay.
Yeah, so he was... You know, they broke up last year, but, like, people still got...
That's pretty legit.
How many Twitter followers does he have?
He has about 10. He had less than I did. Uh-huh. And so it was like... So we did this thing about how, like, you have less Twitter followers and I've been on TV all these times and how come I don't have a check? And, like, we brought in our friend who actually is, he's, like, an expert and he writes about technology and he talked about how he got his check and how it's such a stupid system and he went through it. So we kind of like, and we made it into a campaign to get me verified. and so people were like tweeting at like Twitter to like get him verified. And we did it for like a month and like nothing happened. And I think what ended up happening was that Comedy Central had asked me to do some like Twitter festival they were doing for a day. And then they submitted my name to a list of people to get verified, and I got verified.
And they're like, that's that dude who keeps complaining.
Right. But it was just like, wait, so I did all this stuff, nothing.
That's kinda, so you basically, it's like getting into SAG. But they need you. They just throw you
in. But it's so random. That's the thing. It's like I do all
this
work.
So you basically just had one fucking break after another.
Yeah, this whole thing.
This is the luckiest son of a bitch you'll ever meet.
You have any fucking talent at all?
None. I have none.
Falling into one lucky
dude. Because I don't even think we've talked about half of it yet.
Yeah.
That's not even half of it.
It's the luckiest dude you'll ever meet. Just one lucky coincidence.
Wait a second, because we're not even in order here. Okay, what are we up to? What's the last thing you did
okay,
we talked about that made any sense?
Okay, so we went, grad school, I get the master's, and then I decide I'll do comedy full-time.
Okay, and so you do a Comedy Central Presents there?
Well, no, first, so then it's 2009.
You just did a couple of Live at Gotham.
I did Live at Gotham, I did a Kimmel, and then I did Kimmel first, that was my debut, then I did Live at Gotham, and
you did,
then I did...
John Oliver, right?
That was after, yeah. But there was a year in there where like, I moved back to New York. I'm living with my parents. I'm traveling in the city doing open mics. I figured I had two credits. I could do whatever I wanted in New York.
Yeah, that's not anymore.
No, not at all. I was like working the back room in a tea house in Chinatown. It was like a folk open mic, and I would do like 3 minutes. And it was just humbling. It was just like... I could do whatever I want in Seattle. Why say that? Why are they not letting me do whatever I want?
You people
here?
Don't understand my genius.
Why am I people getting up to get bubble tea? Like, what is
this? This whole business is set up just to keep kicking you in the balls. Right. So it doesn't matter how high you get.
It was important. It was good. I needed it because I forgot. Like, no, it's a different scene. I have to learn how to play by the rules of the scene, and it's a harder scene, and there's a lot of little
niches. You
should have
just got on the local comedy boards and started bitching. And
That's always, whenever comics do that, I'm like, what are you doing? Yeah. Just do the work.
Do you hit mics in L.A. at all ever?
Not as often, because I'm in New York the vast majority of the time. And I'll do something. I'm in, every now and then I'll do a set at like the Melrose Improv, or I'll do like UCB out there, or whatever. There's a bunch. There's
just
more.
Just all the stages he can get on now. Because he can get on all of them.
Well, I just wonder, because I heard there's kind of a similar culture in L.A. where it's hard for some people to actually get up there and get on mics, and even though there's clubs all over the place and mics all the time.
I think there's... L.A., it's harder because of the travel and everything. New York, you can get on a train, you can do 5 or 6 little rooms, but the quality of the rooms always depends. A lot of these rooms are like, if it's not one of the clubs that has a guaranteed built-in audience, you're dealing with like mostly comics, right? You're performing for your peers, and unlike here, like where people will actually listen, out there everyone's like bitter and angry.
Do you
do a lot
of those rooms still?
Every now and then, I still have new jokes that'll work out. I mean, and you can't always like, you know, if I can't get a booked show, because I still there's the best shows. I can only get a couple of times a year.
So are you touring right now or just visiting?
I'm touring. After I finish The Underground, I'm going to Helium in Portland to do the set. And then I record my album in Oakland on Tuesday.
Where at in Oakland?
The New Parish. It's a really cool rock club that's in Oakland. And every time I've had a show there, it's been really fun.
How many seats?
It's standing, but they put in, I think, 170 seats.
Nice.
Yeah,
nice.
It's not. I mean, it's not huge, but it's the sound is good.
Good sound.
The
sound
is good, and I feel. I mean, every time I've been there, I felt comfortable, and I've done that room like, because W. Kamau Bell is from there, so whenever I do shows with Kamau, like it used to be there. So, and Nato Green and my friend Janine Brito, we used to do a lot of shows there, and I feel like even when I was off on that stage, the shows went well.
And what label are you? What are you doing? What's the label?
It's going to be Kill Rock Stars.
What's that? What label?
They're a punk label out of Portland. Like they put out Bikini Kill.
Oh, okay.
Like Elliot Smith. Like, yeah.
Yeah, a lot of these, like Sub Pop has a couple comics as well. Like
Eugene
Merman.
And,
David Cross is on there, I think. They're, in fact, they're in town doing something.
The 25th anniversary of Sub Pop this weekend, right?
So there's a comedy show at what, the Moor?
Yeah.
The Showbox or something?
It's Marin, Kurt Braunohler, John Benjamin, and Eugene.
And then tomorrow they're doing... Georgetown is a concert, free concert with like Mudhoney and I don't even know who all.
I think Jay Maskus from Dinosaur Jr. and
it's like 1996 all over again.
Yesterday, I think it was at the Mudhoney played on top of the Space Needle.
Is that right? Really?
Really?
These guys used to come to the Underground.
Mudhoney?
A lot of these local bands. Yeah, they'd come down there, and I remember them coming down, and you know, everybody would, oh, that's so and so from. I didn't know.
They'd come to the Underground, really.
Yeah, I used to get autographs because my sons were into the
music. It's
kind
of cool.
Who came out? Do you remember?
I don't know.
Just some of those
He didn't
guys.
Care.
Well,
he just knew it happened.
Some famous musician.
Right.
I went to Woodstock. I didn't meet anybody there either.
You went to Woodstock?
Yeah. I turned 22 at Woodstock.
You went to Woodstock?
The Woodstock.
Yeah. The Woodstock.
Yeah.
He was at Altamont, too. With the Rolling Stones
later,
and the Hell's Angels. And
he's one of the dudes that stabbed a guy.
Yeah.
I didn't stab him, but I pushed him into it.
Well, how come you never... Have you talked about this on stage?
Yeah, some, you know, but...
That's incredible.
Yeah.
Well, how long were you there for the whole... were you at Woodstock?
It was a three-day thing, and I left Sunday. And
because
I was in the Army, so I had to hitchhike back to the Army fort.
Yeah. It's hard to imagine you in the Army, man. I know you were, but it's just like
it was a little hard to imagine myself. But it's a long time ago. But
when did you come back? And when did you go? When did you come back? How long was the tour of duty?
I went in 66.
Yeah.
Went to Vietnam 67. Yeah. Came back 68. Got out 69.
Yeah. And jeez. I
mean, never want to go back, you know, never anything like that.
Well, it was interesting because one of the things I loved was when the Iraq War was the thick of it, and you had a bunch of stuff about war. You had a bunch of stuff about how much you were anti-war, and you talked about, like, being a vet. And I love that. I love the fact that you brought that in because it's like it gives you a certain, like, oh, we have to listen. It's not just a comedian stating opinion. It's like a vet who's a comedian who was stating an opinion. Like it was the best.
Yeah,
it's like somebody who lived it
and
knows it.
And has an investment, has a very clear investment. So
not many of us left. And I did a show over in Kitsap, over on the peninsula.
Yeah.
And it was like an Eagles Club or something. A bunch of old farts, right? And I talked about the war a little bit and this and that. And after the show, this guy comes up about my age. And introduced himself, and he said, were you really in Vietnam? And I went, well, yeah, you know, that's not something you'd kid about. He said, you don't have leukemia, do you? And I went, no, I don't think so. He said, oh, too bad. The VA's covering that now.
Nice. Wow.
It's just black military
humor.
You know, like that would be about the best thing that would happen is that you'll get something
that gets covered.
The VA will admit that, well, okay, Agent Orange maybe did give you an extra fucking foot or something, you know. But
have you done any USO stuff or anything?
No.
Would you have interest?
Because You know, I would, but I think I'm a little radical. I think I'm a little left of center, and I don't think that would be the best thing to talk to those guys about.
But at the same time, like, it's coming from a place as a vet that, like, they don't get. How often do they get that?
I don't know.
I'm comics who reform, you know? Like, I know Rob Riggle, but, like, I mean, how many
I know a lot of people that do it, and I think I'm just, it's like, I feel lucky that I was there and I got away.
Right.
You don't want to go back, not even to tell
it. Get back on a helicopter and go back there, that's kind of like, well, you did a lot of flying back in the day. Maybe you got your quota, you know?
Right.
What about you, Ari? Would you ever do that?
I think it's similar. I don't know if my stuff would really... You know, if they would let me, first of all, I'd be surprised. But, like, I don't know if my stuff would work, you know. Some of it would, but some of it I just don't think politically would work.
Really? I mean, you think it'd be too radical? Or?
I wonder. I mean, I've thought about, like, you know, I don't know.
Well, clearly you wouldn't, like, go up there and do, like, a bunch of anti-war material or anything.
Part of me is like, well...
why wouldn't you?
You know what I mean? Like, that's kind of like, well, if you have that on, aren't you supposed to as a comic that actually is worth your grain of salt? Aren't you supposed to? That's my challenge. Like, I'd want to. I'm like, if there's ever a place, this is the place, right? I'm telling a bunch of people who agree with me that war is bad, like, that's fine. But when you have a bunch of folks who are in a very complicated situation and are serving the country in this way, like, wouldn't it make more sense to do it there? Isn't that the challenge? Isn't that where the story is, right?
Yeah. I'm just, I'm surprised. I mean, I think a lot of people would go over there and just like...
Well, I like more ladies in the audience, you know what I'm saying? My thing.
Yeah, I see where you're at.
Man.
I think about it. I have considered it and even been approached to do it, but it's just, I don't know. You know, I'm a lot fucking in a different ballpark, and the only thing we... share in common is that we've been through an experience that was pretty horrific.
But
you know?
That's huge, isn't it? That's a huge
thing. That's a pretty huge thing. You've already
got it reeled in,
you
know?
To base a comedic situation on, you know?
But is it, I mean, if you did it, like, minimally, let's say you did it something like that once, right? Isn't that enough to potentially even write about the experience of doing it? I mean, that could be interesting. Like, if it goes well, it's great. If it doesn't go well, great. The people you talk to after, like, even just what you were telling me about what that vet had told you.
Well, it would be a very emotional thing, and that's the other thing, is that it's something that that means something to me,
right.
You know, those guys. Not that they're over there being heroes. They make out everybody to be a hero to the point where I think it almost cheapens the term, because some of these people obviously are, but... Just because you go over and you do your time and come back, well, you signed up for it, so it is a wonderful thing or whatever. But I don't want to diminish that in any way, and I think it's a very emotional thing. It's like something you do know when you look another person in the eye. You know that you've been through a similar experience.
Right,
you know?
Right.
Did you sign up or were you drafted?
What's that?
Did you sign up or were you drafted?
I enlisted. I was one of seven people in America that enlisted in the fucking service during a war. I would not have been drafted. They did not want me. I had a police record, so that was
detriment.
So did you
just have a deep down desire?
I tried to join the fucking Marines. I tried to join the Navy. I tried to join the Army, the Air Force. All of them said, we'd like to take you, but your criminal background is going to be... And there's a fucking war going on.
So, and was that all born out of a deep desire to protect our freedoms? Was going on? Really? So
sure.
You were into it. You're a big-time patriot.
Yeah, I was...
Wow.
Trying to stop the whole domino thing
from
going
down. This is a whole new Hennigan.
You know?
I didn't even
know.
No, really?
It had nothing to do with that. But I was... I had no money. I had no future.
I had no
high school diploma. And that was a way that I
Where did you grow up?
I could get a Eastern Washington in Yakima and Anchorage, Alaska. And so there was really no hope of going to school, but with a GI Bill, you could get them to help pay for your way. So I thought that's a good way to do it. I wanted to be a psychologist or a psychiatrist or something, help people with broken brains. And so realized somewhere along the line, they don't know what they're doing. So never mind. That's not really a science yet. So, and by then I was shipped off to fucking Vietnam.
Wait, so they did take you eventually then? They had to.
I had to get waivers. I had to get six or seven different waivers.
Yeah.
To say, okay, I guess you're, you know. And it was stupid. I was, you know, I did fine. And they wanted me to go to OCS and become an officer. And, you know. But that was more time. I would have had to sign up for 4 more months.
Right.
And already I hated it.
So right. You were a successful guy, though, in the military, even though you hated it.
Successful? In well, they terms would, you, of I survived it. You
well,
know,
you said they wanted you to go on and be an officer say. And all
yeah,
that.
Yeah, they wanted me to be a second lieutenant. But they don't really... You don't get enough training to really consider yourself a fucking master of the game, you know. If you'd gone to West Point and studied all this tactics and whatnot, I'd think you'd be pretty much able to do that. But just a second lieutenant going through some ROTC shit and going through some fucking... No. And they didn't know what the fuck they were doing in Vietnam. That's the one war we lost. I finally got to go to
war.
And it was on the L side of the fucking deal. You
the
know?
L side.
Yeah. I'm blaming you, Hennigan.
I left in 68, and we were winning.
As soon as you leave, it all goes to hell.
I didn't think I was doing that much,
they blew
truthfully.
It.
But apparently I was holding the fucking thing together.
They blew
I was the glue.
They blew it once you were out the door.
That's
because, you know, we laughed. We had some laughs. Even in the direst of situation, in the worst fucking hole in hell that you can imagine, you will still fucking laugh. That's what makes us human. That's what separates us from, I don't know, the rest of the fucking monkeys, I guess.
Well, and that's one of the things that comics
cars.
Do,
we
I guess.
Cars.
and cars.
And phones. So we're...
Well, I think that's one of the things that comics do, too, is they just encourage people to find the humor in stuff that yeah. is normally really dark or that unapproachable or the type of things that... Because a lot of times a comic will go out on stage and just start talking about shit that people don't talk about, you know. But they find a way to make people laugh about it, and I think that's why there's
like
such...
Like anything?
But that's why there's such a cathartic release for audiences a lot of times when they see a comic who does that, because they get that opportunity to have that discussion, you know.
I mean, I don't think our art form gets enough credit. Like, it's funny, like, you know, people always talk about the great American art forms, and, you know, they focus on jazz and all that. Stand-up's one of them.
And it's hard.
It's
very
hard.
Jazz, isn't it? Isn't that it?
Is it just the two? That's it?
I think
baseball,
so. Stand-up
baseball
and jazz. I
mean, like, it's... I mean, the British, I think they came out with... I think we
yeah,
did.
Baseball, they stole from somebody, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, we stole that from British
cricket.
Rounders, yeah, yeah, yeah. But I mean, I don't know. This is people. Whenever people talk about the thing that scares them the most, it's usually like public speaking. So it's like this is public speaking plus we have to make people laugh. Like it's terrifying.
That was the hardest part for me. Was just going up that first time. I probably spent 3 years just thinking about going up that first time. Never, because I just could not get over the idea. Because I'm not a public person. I don't like to draw attention to myself.
Right.
And,
wait a fucking minute. What does that mean about the rest of us?
What now?
If you're not, that. That means we are. Because I couldn't wait. Give me that fucking microphone.
yeah,
come
shit.
On. Hey, I got some shit to say. I got never a problem. I don't think it's, you know what I mean? It's just
no, I get it, you know. And, you know, maybe that's because you go up there and you freeform it and you're relaxed or not. I'm still, like, not relaxed or natural about it, you know. And
well,
I
you
been,
just
you know.
practice, right? I wasn't either. I had to practice because I was terrified of the audience.
Well, willingness to fail is such a big part of this because most of this is failing. I mean, that's how you get good, right? Like,
yeah. Well, when we talked about,
and is it failure? I mean, it's really how you define success. If that's, hey, they laugh at every goddamn thing I said tonight. That's success.
Right. And we talked about before how you almost have to reach a point to where you don't really care if you don't get that big laugh, but
right.
obviously at the same time, deep down, you do, because
right.
otherwise
sure.
you wouldn't be doing it. So it's a weird balancing trick that you have to do.
Kind of.
Well, it's a Zen thing, isn't it? I mean, it's like you're doing, but you're not attached to the doing. You're not attached to the results of what you're doing.
And that gets back.
You're just in the moment. That's
yeah.
why I like free form, because...
But you'll get completely at ease and feel comfortable to do it. I mean, it'll just happen.
But it's all, the thing is, just you want the big laugh. But sometimes, you know, there'll be jokes that I do where, like, or shows that I do, not even just jokes, where, like, 100 people in a room, maybe 20 of them laughed. 20 of them. The rest of them are just kind of like, eh, you know? And you can leave that show. I used to leave that show just depressed. Like, what happened? Like, I was doing fine, and this thing happened. And then all of a sudden, you start thinking about those 20 people laughed despite the fact they were the vast minority in that room.
That's awesome.
They had to laugh upstream, right? There was no way for them to, like, everyone's telling them this isn't funny, but they're like, no, it is funny. I'm going to laugh despite the fact you're staring at me, right? And those 20 people are going to bring their friends next time, and that's what's going to make a great show. And it's just, that attitude, I think a lot of comics need that. I definitely needed that. Like, okay, this is still worth it for them, and they'll come back. As long as they come back, we're okay.
Do you have any jokes you do just for you?
Oh, yeah, there's a bunch of stuff. There's a bunch of, almost all of it. You know, like some of the jokes I'm telling you, they're just 4-minute setups before I get to anything. You know, that's for me. Like, there's not...
And is there just, like, radio silence as you're doing the 4-minute? Or do you throw tags in there?
But there's, like, little jokes here and there, but, like, it's building to... I like the jokes that fail, and I have to explain it, and the explanation is the joke. Like, the thing that comic Stuart Lee, like, seeing... He was doing things I've never seen anybody do before. Like, he embraces silence. Like, he'll get to it when he gets to it. Like, his last special, I think it had... maybe 6 or 7 proper jokes in it, and the rest of it was kind of just building for the hour and a half and how it all comes together towards the end.
Yeah,
and
I feel that way about some of Bill Hicks's later stuff.
Oh,
like, he just starts ranting, and there's not even, like, a joke in there, and he just goes on and on and on, and he's, like, yelling and screaming about just, like, really deep political, sociological stuff, and you realize... It's been like 15 minutes and there hasn't been a single laugh. But people,
but people watch,
still enthralled. You know, they can't look away.
They still talk about him in like the UK all the time. Like, he gets mentioned all the time. Like, he's still like the biggest influence that we've had on them. Like Bill Hicks.
Well, and no slight on Bill Hicks, but then again, I mean, look at the state of comedy in the UK. I'm not real sure that there's. I'm just saying.
If you're going to talk shit about Benny Hill again, I'm walking.
Hey, Jerry Lewis is huge in France, right? So that's all you need to know.
I mean, there's some incredible comics there, but I think they kind of fall into the same thing we do here, where like the people who do like the poppiest shit will move further, and the folks who are taking real risks, you know. But the difference is that they have like the Edinburgh Festival, so they basically
Did that, right?
I did that 1 year. I did like a 20.
When did you do your Conan then? Before that or after?
After that.
Oh,
after
okay.
That.
So Edinburgh.
I did Edinburgh in 2011, and I'd never done it. It's a month long festival. You basically perform every night for a month, and it's
fell in his lap.
I didn't ask for it, and they were just like, "Would you like to do the festival? Pay your way." I'm like, "Yeah, all right, I'll do it."
Stanhope did that too. Was that any time?
That is every bit as
inspirational
as anything.
Yeah.
Just the fact, you know, because sometimes you can try so hard to make something happen. And I think we each have our own individual path.
Sure.
And we get so screwy watching other people going, well, shit, I should have been able to do that.
No.
And that should have been. And it's got nothing to do with you.
No.
It's your path is your path.
Yeah.
And sometimes it looks easy. I doubt that your path is any easier than anybody else's, because I think you have to deal with just
different
things.
Stuff. Yeah,
you know,
he had to run for council in high school just to get started.
This is all because I won that election. I it was a damn good speech. Actually, it's funny. Actually,
well, at least you captured the spirit of politics right
there. Right
after
that. But the I had a joke in the beginning of that speech that like got a huge laugh, and it's the same joke that I did to open my Kimmel set.
That's awesome.
So the joke I wrote when I was 16 or so to win to get that comedy, it was the same joke I did the first opening.
Do you still do that joke?
No, it's an awful joke.
What's the oldest joke that you have? I mean, do you still
right
do
it? Now?
I want to know that fucking joke that lasted for
you remember,
30 goddamn years.
You remember that? I used to do that all the time in Seattle. It was so stupid. I was embarrassed.
You gotta tell it now.
I walk out on stage and it's a audience. I'm just.
I hope it's on tape.
Oh, this joke? No, yeah.
Is it on
it's,
YouTube?
Yeah, it's on my Kimmel set. It's the first
joke
on my Kimmel
set. We're gonna get it.
It's so terrible. I regretted saying it on Kimmel as soon as I said it. I'm like, oh, this is gonna suck forever that I put this on.
Did it work though?
Yeah, of course it worked. It's a good joke.
That's all you need.
But it's I went out and I was but it was just.
Dude, you're playing this down so much. It's gonna be great.
I hate the joke.
Oh, okay. Let's hear it.
It goes. I'm so nervous to be here. You know, it's a big show for me. My stomach's been a mess. I've had butterflies. My stomach's been a mess. And for a while there, I thought maybe I wasn't actually nervous. Maybe I was pregnant. But But of course, that's impossible because I'm a virgin.
Boom.
And then high school audience loved it. And the Kimmel audience loved it. And which, what does that say about Kimmel audience? And
it's not that bad of a joke.
And it's fine. It's like a well-structured, well-written joke. But it's like, what am I doing? Why am I saying I'm a virgin? Why am I doing this? Because it's an easy laugh.
Right.
And I wanted that. But like I've regretted that joke. It's like it's not a.
Well, back to Edinburgh.
Yeah.
How do you say it, by the way?
Edinburgh. Yeah.
It's a night of pronunciations. I'm learning all sorts of new words. How long were your sets? You performed every night for a month.
I did 20s. I did 20s.
Did
mostly.
You have to go get a theater and the whole thing, or did they put you in a show?
They put
what?
Me in a show. So Avalon, the company that signed me, the management company, they're really a British company originally, right? And so they were like one of the two big British companies. And so they had this thing called Comedy Zone where they like introduce new acts. And Edinburgh is basically where you make your name in the UK. And if you have a good Edinburgh show, you're set. Like, but the only problem with that is all these comics basically do new hours every single year. You're expected to do a new hour. You can't repeat material. And eventually you hope like somebody discovers you, you get a TV show or something or a big tour and it happens. But the thing is you invest thousands of dollars every year on these shows, which you never get back. So you don't get the money back, so you're in debt every single year
You personally invested money in this.
Yeah, well, I didn't.
Because he has to go there and live there for a month.
I had to
so
pay.
They don't pay your travel or your
They didn't. I covered all that. The hope was that we made enough money off the thing where it'd cover most of the expenses.
If you don't mind me asking, how much money did you spend on this?
I'm not sure. I ended up losing a couple of thousand.
Jeez.
And so, the way it works is the management company has like that debt that you owe them because they kind of cover it, right? So then you have to pay it off, which I did with some other gigs and stuff.
This
but
almost
it's like
falls under the same umbrella that we've talked about before about how sometimes it seems like comics are just expected to work for exposure,
right?
You know, like that's supposed
to
be your payment.
But some of it has to happen. I mean,
but their system is very different than ours because their system is all about that festival. Everything is that, and they're a smaller country than we are, and they have a smaller market. So everything is about that festival, and as a result, it kind of does happen where like comics are in these deep holes that they'll never get out of, and
right.
And they're but if they break big, they'll get out of it and they make a ton of money.
It's kind of a gamble. It's like you're going to Vegas and you just better have your shit together.
Yeah, yeah.
Did you do the same 20s every night?
I mixed up a little bit and I wrote a couple of new things, but you know, everyone said, you know, you can just do the same 20, but I got bored, you know. So I did some because part of it is I was doing a UK audience, so I didn't have that much stuff. I had hours of material from the U.S. that really I only had about 20 minutes that I could do there anyway.
Did you ever just totally eat shit, or did it all?
Oh, I ate shit a few times where I'm like, none of this is hitting, and I don't know.
In rooms that were how full?
Rooms,
like, were most of the rooms full all the time?
Varied. Okay. I mean, because basically we had the same room every single night. It was a late show, so it was like around close to it was like 11:30 midnight every single night.
How was the venue?
Venue was great. It was great. But, like, you know, if you're having a late show and everyone's drinking all day and you get there, you know, and imagine that every night. So the weekdays were fine, but the weekends could be rough, just like any other place.
Do you think there's ever, like, a cultural divide that was part of the problem?
Certainly. I mean, it's confusing, too, as somebody who talks about race a fair bit. Part of what makes it work is I'm coming from an outsider perspective. When I'm in the UK, I'm an American, which is ironic, right? So setting the outsider perspective is confusing. Why are you talking about that? You're an American. We see you as an American. Like, ah, crap, really?
That's funny.
This is not useful to me in this context.
Just ruined a great bit, people.
Right. So, I mean, you'd have to build
so you
a bit more.
Just switched it up, right?
I had a different set of stuff. I wrote stuff, you know, and the other comics were kind of like, why are you writing? So you're supposed to do it. I'm like, I don't have stuff. I don't know how to play this. I got to figure it out. And, you know, and that was great. I was like,
long did it take you to adapt?
To that, yeah. It took a bit. I mean, I'd done some bit stuff in the UK before, but like not like this, you know. So it took the whole. By the end of the month, I was fine. Like I had my the thing down, you know. I had some rough shows. I had some great shows. And
were you just totally exhausted?
Done. I was. They said around week three, you start to lose it a little bit. Okay. It happens to everybody. But I'd been doing warm up shows in the UK for 2 weeks before that. So this was. I was like week five. I did 6 weeks away from home where I was just like grinding it out. But you know, I was impressed as all hell because all these comics, they had their hours, man. They were doing the same hour every single day, and they get reviewed. They get reviewed by papers.
Did you get reviewed?
A couple, you know, because I was in a group show with like three other comics, each doing like 15 and 20s, right? So the reviews are a little different. We don't get reviewed as much because it's one of those standard, well, this is like the standard comedy club type show. But the other shows, it's like you put your work in for a whole year. You spend thousands of dollars. So some college kid who has a summer job reviewing shows for some paper gives you 3 stars and you're fucked. It's the worst fucking, it's the terrible system.
It's probably the third comedy show this kid's seen.
Ever
dude,
seen. All, and then he's like telling people on in these papers what your jokes are and why they're not good.
And it's
like,
the UK, so he's a huge fan of Jerry Lewis.
Right. I mean, isn't that the French?
It is the French.
The French, whatever.
I mean, like they're, I mean, I you know, people always think the British fans are incredible. They're so smart, right? And I'm like, no, there's some incredibly smart audiences and there's fucking drunk idiots. It's just like here.
No.
And it's the exact same.
It is,
there,
yeah.
There are people like us, and there's like a wide range. So
they know what's going on in our pop culture more
absolutely.
than we know about them.
Absolutely.
At all.
Well, we don't know anything about anybody else. Unless
no,
we're
I've been
at
watch-
war with them, then we got
I've been watching
Globe to see where the fuck is Afghanistan. You
yeah.
know?
Well, on Apple TV, you can get the Sky News, and it's so different because that's the BBC. Or
Sky
British.
News is their...
their CNN.
Yes. Yeah.
But
yeah.
they cover us like you wouldn't yes. believe, like crazy.
Yes. I mean, their BBC News is great. That's great. Al Jazeera is fucking great. Al Jazeera, there especially, I don't know what the U.S. version's like, but there it's like, because I had never seen it because, you know, we always talk about it with like a, ooh, you know, over here, and I would see
it
regularly.
Put you on a list if you go.
Yeah, right. yeah. We just gained the NSA as a listener to the podcast. Right.
No, you won't be flying anyway.
But like, I'd watch it there, and I'm like, holy shit, this is great. The interviews are great. The coverage is great. It's like,
and there's all these stories that you do
never
not
hear. Never
in
hear.
In fact,
about.
I was watching Facebook today, and the girl that got shot by the Taliban in the head was at the UN doing a speech. That was not I didn't see any of that come across Facebook today. I saw Trayvon Martin. And George Zimmerman.
Oh, that. Yeah. Did you see the picture of depressed the fuck out of him? Because they accidentally showed the picture on MSNBC of Trayvon.
Did they accidentally show that
picture? They're not supposed to show it because like it's a trial photo, and they didn't cut away fast enough, so people got a still of the kid's body. And so then that was all over Facebook, and it was just like, I wasn't ready to, when I signed on, it wasn't ready to see that. It was the most depressing
thing. I kind of agree. I kind of have to wonder if they accidentally, like,
whether they.
Dude.
Well, you know, because now everybody's talking about it, maybe the ratings, you know.
What a terrible thing to do. What a terrible thing. Because the family didn't okay it. They're supposed to okay that. Yeah. Anyway, yeah, we get our, I mean, there's dummies there, too. It's the same with the UK or here. But, yeah. Yeah, so that's it. The whole career has been lucky.
It's all luck. If you want a comedy career, all you have to do is roll the dice.
So it's just a fluke, basically.
Just a fluke. It's
no
whole,
advice for anybody. Be lucky.
Be lucky. I mean, look, you know, you go to open mics, you fail a ton, and you are prepared for an opportunity, whatever that opportunity
is. No, you fucking worked hard, and I think you put a lot into it, man, and it shows.
I mean, it's also being willing to, I mean, that's why it always bums me out when I see comics, and like, oh, they only do the rooms in Capitol Hill? And it's just like, no, man, it's a weekend set. How come you're not here on a weekend trying to get a guest set? How come you're not going to Tacoma? How come you're not, you know?
Yeah, there was no other comics here tonight, huh?
Some come to watch, but I'm like, how come? I've been here on other weekends where I've come to get a guest set, and I'm like, oh, are the other comics trying to get a guest set? And I'm like, no, it's just you. And I'm like, are you kidding me? How come everyone isn't here? This is the only real audience you get all week. Yeah. On a weekend, like 50, 100,
like
150.
It gets real clicky, too. Like, somebody will open up a room somewhere, and then the next thing you know, like, they all just hang out at that room.
I mean, it's all, like, so small at the end of it. None of this is going to help you, like, this kind of clickiness. I remember when I was here, that was one great thing. Like, Peter had done that comedy night show in Queen Anne, and there was that split between Giggles and the Underground, which is so stupid that the two clubs and so the comics had this real rivalry, and Peter had the show. And so all the Giggles comics and Underground comics would perform together, and they met each other and hung out and wrote sketches together. And it was like, this is great. And this is what a scene is. Like, you actually build stuff together, and you work the clubs, and you work the alt rooms, and you work the road. You work all of it because it's all stage time. And you're in Seattle. Like, that's one of the great parts of it. There's not a ton of industry here. Like, it's not like anyone's going to judge you in a way, you know, and that's the end of your career. No, you just keep building and you
yeah,
learn.
Yeah, you can develop. I mean,
there's groups. There's groups of guys that are working together and trying to make things happen. I think it's always the same in every scene. There's going to be people that are different personalities.
Well, I think ironically, Facebook encourages a lot of that clickiness because people build their little Facebook communities and then it carries over into real life.
This guy supports this guy in this fight, and everybody takes it to the.
And Facebook should be the opposite. You know, it should be opening up avenues.
I remember when MySpace started, like, we started building these like forums, you know, like group things, and it was great. Like that, we got a lot of us got together, and we started building, and like, oh, we just found a new room, we should book a thing there, and like, yeah, that's what you got to do. This is not that big of a scene, really.
Right.
And that's the biggest strength of it is that like you can get stage time. Like coming from New York, like it was like, oh, I can just go up, and you're gonna give me time. I pay $3 for comic relief. And Carl asks you to do it, you do it, and you go up. That's it. That's great. Oh my God! Like, it always bums me out. Like when I see comics that are complacent. Like they talk a lot, but they're complacent. It's like the scene gives you everything. I think just the audience is the biggest asset.
Yeah, because you can go up on a Saturday night.
Yeah.
Do a guest set or do a host set or whatever. You're playing to fucking 50 people or 100 people. That's a whole different thing than open mic or playing in a bar and. Middle of nowhere that nobody's listening to you. It helps.
In New York, you can't get 50 people at a show when you're starting out.
Oh, yeah.
I just think
Seattle has that vibe where they always supported whatever's their thing.
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, that's why the bands get big. That's why so much music came out of here. It's because, dude, there's nothing else to do here. It's raining. So you go inside and you drink and watch bands or comedy or whatever.
And there is that love of local. It's like, this is what, like, I only lived here 2 years and I get seen as local, which I appreciate greatly. And I love the city a great deal, but it's like, That's Seattle. Like the fact that you're trying to do something, you get 10% for participation here.
Right.
Honestly, they give you credit for trying.
Get a merit badge.
And Portland is the hurry of comedy because everything fell in their lap.
Oh,
they got
God.
Portlandia and all. We don't have a show. You know, we got nothing here in terms of that.
Yeah.
They got the Bridgetown Festival.
That Bridgetown Festival
just
changed
exploding.
Everything. Have you gone down there yet?
I went to the first one, I think.
What'd you think?
I thought it was great.
It's like a summer camp with a bunch of
clowns.
Yeah, they
had all this. I mean, it's well organized. Yeah. They had all the stuff going on.
But Seattle still has
it. I'm jealous. But you know, they do it.
Well, we got the International Comedy Competition, right? I mean,
we have our thing, but I mean, they really did fucking.
But it is kind of cool because a lot of the Seattle comics hang with the Portland comics. Yeah. I mean, we know a ton of those guys, like Dwight Slade and Art Krug. So it's almost like a little sister scene, which has become the big sister,
right? Which is so weird. I can't believe.
But it's cool.
Yeah, I mean, it's great, and that festival's great, and Helium, and like they got.
And there's quite a few people out of there that are doing stuff, like Christine Levine, got Ron Funches.
Oh, Ron!
And they were a one club town for so long.
It was just Harvey's,
really
right?
Kept it in. Yeah.
And Ian Carmel's coming
Ian's
out of there.
Great.
He's popping.
Ian's doing really well.
Yeah, he's very funny.
I'm glad for Funches. That was another thing. Like, when Funches got on Conan and stuff, like, so much of the city was excited. Like, it was a big deal that Ron made it. Just because, like, it's like Seattle. Like, if someone local does well, it just means more. It just means more. Like, that's one cool thing. When that Kimmel thing happened, I didn't tell anybody when all this stuff was happening with the HBO thing. And I didn't want to tell anybody because I thought that would, like, be weird. To like, no one's really doing anything, and if I mention, oh, this guy at the HBO thing and Kimmel people, like, it would be divisive because we were building something, you know. I didn't want to fuck it up.
Yeah.
So I got the news, and I had to tell people because I'm like, I'm gonna be on TV this week, you know. And everyone was stunned. Like, what do you mean you're gonna be on TV this week? Like, what are you talking about? We're at Mars Bar doing a show. What are you doing? And I was nervous also because I thought I would be annoyed or angry and stuff. And everybody was happy. Like, I remember Andy Peters was like, oh, I'm performing in Montana, and you're fucking just doing shows in Seattle. I got it all wrong, and then he was just, and everyone just gave me a hug, and it was just like great. And then they watched the thing at the Canterbury and Capitol Hill, and they like, Kevin Richards brought his camera to film everyone's reaction to it, but he got so nervous he forgot to put it on, and like, and everybody was texting, and it was like that's what it means to be in a small scene. Like, there's love there. There's not like bitterness. It's like one of us made it. That's what people kept saying. One of us made it.
And yeah, exactly.
Well, yeah, and then when Ty and Craig come back to town, always, you know, it's all hugs.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's fun to have them in the room because there's electricity. Everybody's excited. It's fun.
And that's something like New York or LA can't really get. You know, they don't know that feeling of like the hometown hero coming back because nobody knows who's the hometown. Because they're all there for comedy.
Well, LA is LA.
This is like you actually are invested in the place, and the place is invested in you. It's really special in that way, man. Every time I'm back, like these crowds this weekend, I thought they'd be all right, but I didn't think they'd be like this. They've been wonderful, and they came out, and it's.
And where are these people coming from? Do you think, like, they're fans of you from what?
I think from doing shows here for a while. Because I mean,
aren't you a writer and correspondent? Yeah, on a show like right now.
I'm totally biased. Yeah.
What's that on?
It was on FX. It's moving to FXX, which is their new comedy channels. They're moving like Always Sunny in Philadelphia, and they're moving I think Archer and a bunch of their comedy programming there.
Do you find it like? Does it throw you off at all? Like when you first started and nobody knew who you were, you just came in, you did your thing. Mm. You could get a pretty good read on what people were laughing at, what they weren't laughing at. These people seem to have a pretty good idea what you were about.
Yes. Yeah. But that was the thing I was telling you about, just like when the 20 people laugh, they'll come back. And so I started just putting email lists out. So I'm like, if you like my stuff, just let me write it down. I'll let you know when I do a thing. And that's really why this happened. It was just years of just collecting people's emails. And people, you know, would say, do you have anything to sell? And I still have. This album's my first thing I would have, you know. But I said, no, but if you give me your email, let you know when I'm in town again. And you can bring your friends. And that's what kept happening. That's why these shows have been great. I mean, it really the old way of doing it. Just connecting with people. And people, like, they want to support you. Like, if they had a good time, they really want to support you. They want to come back. And they want to tell their friends and show their friends. And
that's one of the tricks to comedy is you got to, like, when people leave, they need to feel like, you know, you're buddies now. Like, they're somehow friends with you because they had that experience.
But and a lot of times I feel that way, too, though. Like, when a show goes really well, it feels like I was just hanging out with a bunch of friends that I don't know.
Aren't you podcasting, too? Like, don't you have a lot of listeners? Don't you do something with your brother?
You do a talk show with your brother, right?
Me and my brother do a live podcast. We do a podcast, and we also do a live show. But I don't think that has a ton of, I don't think it has a ton of listeners. We have a decent base.
You've got a buzz. I mean, you know, my son, who's, you know, probably about your age. I don't know. How old are you?
30.
Yeah, he's about your age. He knows who you are very well, and he knows your stuff, and he's heard your, you know. And so, like, you make a connection with these people that you could just feel it ripple through the audience. Like, they know what he's about. It's just... I thought, is that throw you off because they're more receptive in a way than when you were anonymous, when you were just comic number three?
But the thing is, comedy's not, like, I'm not at a level where that's consistent, right? Because when I'm in New York, I'm anonymous again. you know what I mean?
So what throws me off
is coming from New York when I'm, you know, it's offense and defense, right? Like, when I'm in New York, I'm more on the defense. I'm ready for a joke not to work and having to fix it. And when I'm in Seattle, I'm on the offense. I'm in control. I know what I can do. I don't need to fight. The only defense is...
So you just have little pockets of areas that you go into.
Yeah, sure. And when I'm in New York, I headlined Caroline's for the first time, which was great, you know? And it was great also because my parents knew what it was. That's what it really comes down to, right?
It's not Bob's Burgers or
right.
whatever.
It's they awesome. Know what Caroline's is. They've seen it on TV or they've heard about it. Like, that was the one that we're from Queens, so it was the big club in Manhattan that they knew. And for them to see me at Caroline's was like a huge deal. Like, that was a big deal to me. But, like, you know, that I drew pretty well for that. But, like, that's because I advertised the show. I'm like, I'm doing the show, and people in New York, you've said you want to see me, and this is the show to see me. But, you know, most of the shows are, you know, I have to get through them like everybody else. And there's a lot of, they're not always pleasant. And you know, there's a few good shows. But like I was saying, like, maybe a couple of times a year I can get booked on the ones that are great, hot shows. And a lot of them are just shows you work stuff out at.
How was it with your parents in the audience?
Oh, they're fine. I mean, it was funny. I told my mom, like, look, I'm talking about sex a bit. I used to not do that. So, you know, you got to be prepared for that. And they didn't.
Have they been supported the whole time?
I mean, yeah. I mean, it's strange because I'm moving out to Seattle. I told them I was going to go to law school. I didn't, you know. So I think initially it was like, okay, what are you doing? I'm going to...
Hanging out in bars, telling jokes.
Right.
But you're still getting degrees. So
and they were happy with
no
that.
No parent is ever going to be happy to hear that their kid wants to be a fucking stand-up.
No.
I mean, that's why I wondered when you finally played a place that they'd heard of.
It's being resigned to the fact or accepting, but it's not like yippee, you know?
Yeah,
I mean, it's
never, yeah.
It's, I mean, they for, you know, I saw the transition too, because for a while there, they were telling people I was an actor, even though I've never acted in a thing, and it's just because that made sense to them, and it didn't feel embarrassing.
That's more legitimate
than a comedian.
Well, that's what I was wondering, if the Caroline's gig like legitimized it for.
Well, I think I think the TV stuff I legitimized, but the Caroline's gig, I think, it's like they can say my kid performed at Caroline's. You know, they can say that, and you know, if I ever get a chance to be on Letterman, that's another one. It's like they know what Letterman is. They watch Letterman. Well, they like Letterman.
You got your own Wikipedia page too, right? Like, aren't they impressed?
My dad, I think, gets somewhat impressed. My mom doesn't give a shit. She's great. That's why my mom does not give a shit.
So she's the ultimate control.
The last time my mom got excited about accomplishment, I got 165 on a practice LSAT exam. A practice LSAT exam, and she was excited about the 165 on a practice. I haven't seen her smile that much since then. I mean, she has good perspective. She's a very, like, you know, she's like, I expect you to do well. You're my kid. Of course I expect you to do well. And whatever it is, you're good at what you do. Why should I be excited about you? I know you're going to be good.
And how does the Wikipedia page, does that just pop up randomly, or?
Oh, just the fact that it exists?
Yeah, well, I know people who would, like, saw off a leg to get a Wikipedia page.
Well, there's a format you have to follow. You have to have some legitimate credits that you can link to. I mean,
somebody put it up after the Kimmel thing. I think you need something to be like that.
Yeah, there's a lot. There's people that watch these shows. Yeah.
I think after Caroline's.
After Caroline's,
his mom put it up.
He's legitimate. He's got a Caroline's. Fuck it.
Yeah. I know some people who have credits and they've like tried and tried and tried,
really?
And they just don't show up on Wikipedia. Nobody knows, like, and then like all of a sudden, just randomly, people's pages pop up and everybody wonders like what the magic.
Well, like I said, there's a certain format they have to be written in that format. You don't have to do it. You have to have somebody do it, but it's not that hard to
do. A lot of it too is just finding articles and things that say that, like, oh, this person's a thing.
Yeah, you have to link to it and show the legitimacy of what you're saying. That's all. So it's a little bit of work, but you can get it done. But usually if he goes on TV once, somebody will jump on it.
Right. Like, this is a thing now, whatever it is.
Yeah.
He's for real.
Right.
He's verified on Twitter, by the way. We need to get that Wikipedia
that's
page.
That's why I wanted to grab you before you fucking explode and we'll return our calls and shit, you know.
I'm happy. Like, I really wanted you to host, like, this week. I thought it would be fun just to, like, have you on the show. Because we've never done a show together than, like, open mics and things. And it just seemed like
It was an honor. Like I said, I wouldn't drive downtown on Friday.
But you were always that comic, like for a lot of us, you know, you were the one that we kind of looked up to, and like, this is the way it's supposed to look, and you know, like, just how your ease on stage, and like the fact that you would take whatever was there and you would build something, and you had material, but you didn't need it if you didn't, you know, if you saw something else, you'd go where you had to go.
Yeah, because it's open mic.
Well, not even
that's
your headlining says.
Me,
well,
though.
The funny thing is, I don't know if I ever told you this, Hennigan, but. Like I said, I thought a long time about doing an open mic before I actually decided to do one. And unfortunately, the first open mic in Seattle I went to was at Giggles. And this was right when Giggles was like on the outs. Like they were moments away from shuttering the doors. And so it was just one of those mics where I think I was maybe one out of four people in the audience. And the comics that were there were a bunch of guys who just didn't care, you know.
Right.
And so it kind of scared me away. Like, I was like, I don't think I'm going to go up, you know. And then a couple weeks later, I realized, oh, there's this other club, the Comedy Underground, down in Pioneer Square. I'll go down there and see. And then I went down there, and I saw you go up, and I was like, man, that guy killed it. Like, then it, like, turned me back on to open mics. And then, like I said earlier, I came back to actually go up, and you were hosting. And that was my first open mic. So it's your fault, basically, is what I'm saying.
Now, Hennigan is modest because he does go out and go up on the open mics, but he'll also go, like, go to Parlor and do a feature set in front of a major headliner, or go out and close other rooms. So it's like he'll just do all of it.
Now, I'm glad that modern comedian thing happened. I'm glad that Scott did that.
Wasn't that great?
That was great.
That kind of surprised me, but.
Well, I mean,
I was honored. You know, once again, it's like, really?
When Scott told me he was doing that, I'm like, that's the best. That's like, it made complete sense, and I'm glad it happened. And because there's such cool pieces, the stuff that he's doing.
Yeah, Hari doesn't have a modern comedian piece. Come on.
Yeah, take that, Comedy Central. But you know what? It just fell in my lap. And actually, it fell in his lap first. He couldn't do it.
He was busy. He had that Edinburgh.
No, Try Hennigan. He ain't working. You know, he can. Scott. He's got a dog.
He's another local guy. He's a Seattle guy. Scott.
Yeah.
He's from Spokane.
Where's he at now?
He's in New York.
Well, so a bunch of those guys, Andy and
Andy's done great. Andy Haynes has done great.
And Scott, and there's a couple other guys.
Carroll's still out there. And David Cope was here for a minute, but I think he moved to L.A.
There was just such a bunch. It's always that way. There's, waves. It's like, okay, we're ready, and off they go. Yeah. And it's just wonderful. And it's the same thing. It's like, that's one of ours, That's one of our guys.
I can't wait to see what else everyone's going to do. Like, there's that time period, I felt like there was a bunch of folks coming up quickly at the same time, and we supported each other.
Yeah, there was just a whole wave, and it's like, now there's another whole wave of people that are doing the same thing, and it's really a strong community that is formed because we had to, basically. Mm-hmm. We've outgrown the
We've been able to have a barbecue every year.
Really?
Yeah.
What are you doing?
We pull it off once a year. We just go to Golden Gardens, and I think we're at, the third year now?
Yeah, we set fire to some fucking shit.
Does everybody come out, or is it kind of...
Yeah, it's pretty good. Even people that don't get along come out.
Yeah.
It's comics, so they're all fucking coming out by themselves, and one guy in a car, I think we're just such a revenge of the nerds. It's like, people that are just odd have a real place in this. Yeah. You don't have to be anything but here.
And that's the great. I mean, open mics are kind of amazing in that way, right? Because you get to, because it's also a lot of folks who like. It's less about the comedy. It's more about the therapy of talking to somebody.
Yeah.
And it's like kind of a beautiful thing. And it's weird, like, I hear people say, like, oh, there's no punchline in that. And I'm like, it's not about the joke, man. This person needs this. This has nothing to do with just be nice. They're happy to talk to people.
There's a limit, though. We've had some discussions about some people who probably just shouldn't, like, they should seek their therapy.
I don't know.
Right.
But even that train wreck is sometimes beautiful. I enjoy those sometimes more.
There's an open mic in San Francisco called the Brainwash. Have you ever heard of that?
Uh-uh.
That's like their first open mic. That's like the one where everyone has to work through the Brainwash to get anything else because their clubs are hard to break into and, the punchline and all that. So the Brainwash, it's a laundromat where they have comedy. So already,
We went there when we were auditioning for Last Comic Standing.
Oh, so then you... Yeah, yeah.
And we went to that.
It's brutal.
It's in San Francisco?
In San Francisco,
it's a laundromat?
I think so.
It's a laundromat cafe, but it's really a laundromat. People are like checking their wash and then coming back to the open mic. And
so what happens?
So everybody goes...
So the comics are doing their laundry too?
Sometimes, I think. But they all do like a few minutes, but it's one of those things where even homeless folks go up and they do a set, and they're regulars at that thing. Like, oh, it's this homeless guy's set. It's
and
his
you
regular
did, you
thing.
Did this mic?
I chose not to. I got there, and I was like, I don't think I want to do this.
I don't think I did it either.
Are you actually telling jokes like as people are folding their laundry and stuff, or is it in a different area?
It's in a different... but not really. It's kind of in a different area, but you can see the machines, right? Like, do you remember?
I was only there one time, and I don't think I went up. I just kind of watched it. And
it's like watching a wreck, but at the same time, it's like that interesting, like, folks who don't go up anywhere else except that one place.
Well, it's kind of ironic. This weekend, myself and Anthony Robinson, a local comic, we just strolled into a random laundromat and just posted up and just, ladies and gentlemen. And,
Really?
Yeah, and we filmed it. We got it on tape. And I did an intro just real quick, please silence your cell phones, keep your table talk to a minimum. And we brought Anthony up there, and he did like 3 minutes.
Yeah.
And there was maybe six, seven people in there.
Dude, I think you should have had to do an hour.
Well, we didn't. We put zero planning into this. We were like, let's just show up and like just post up and do this. Just start doing it.
Did the people pay attention?
That's the crazy part. They loved it. Like, he killed the place. And the funny thing is, like I said, we didn't put any planning or attention into it. We just went in there. And I later in hindsight, I thought, well, you know what? You're in a laundromat. You've probably been staring at your, you know, your clothes in the dryer for 45 minutes.
Who
you're
books
bored.
That?
You have to.
I think it's a triple gig.
Yeah, you're starved for attention and or for entertainment. And these people, like, they actually like warmed up to it, and we got a lot of laughs. And
he did about seven.
No, he only did like 3 minutes. You know, because it was just like we didn't know what to expect or what we were doing. Right after that, we went to a Safeway and posted up in the frozen foods aisle, and that one didn't go
you're
quite
as well.
You're
trying out some new venues, huh?
Yeah, yeah, you know. Well, you know, if you can't...
Thinking outside the fucking box.
Yeah, if you can't get those guest spots at the clubs on the weekend, then you got to, like, take the show to the people is
right.
What we're doing. And
I love that.
But the laundromat reminded me of that, because actually I was surprised the laundromat... Like, I'm thinking about doing a laundromat tour, just like picking like 10 or 12
That's
laundromats
fine.
And just going around, because they loved it. They were like, that was awesome, a comedy Have show.
Fun.
I'm ready.
Have fun.
No, I think it'd be great, man.
50
I think
loads
funny,
in
man.
50 days.
50 loads in 50 days and 50. You have to do it in 50 states, though, fucker, because that's not cool.
Well, no, I'd rather just drive around town. Really, you know. Laundromats can be great places for comedy, though.
Are we going to close on that? Should we start
yeah,
the song?
Yeah, we better.
Yeah, it's 2:30 in the morning, and I think we covered every subject that there was.
This was fun, guys. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for coming out, man.
Thank
it was
you,
awesome.
Man.
It was great.
Appreciate it.
Of course.
Stand
is
up
our
late.
Song playing? Are we just going to...
Yeah, I can end out on the song.
Yeah, we should.
Play that song, my man.
That's what we're supposed to end on anyway, right? Yeah, I know.
Yeah, we got fucking music, right? Some local band that doesn't have enough money to sue us for it. Put it on there. Fuck those
they
guys.
They have explicitly given us permission to use their song.
That's awesome.
See how we're bantering right now?
No, I think that was good, man. That was fun.
Wow. Great time.